Intersections is recorded, produced, and distributed on the territories that have been stolen from the Coast Salish nations of the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. The members of the Gender Empowerment Collective seek to dwell within and reckon with these historical truths of dispossession and violence as we dream and curate conversation towards more whole worlds.
Good morning and welcome to Intersections as presented by the Gender Empowerment Collective. We're here at CITR 109 FM broadcasting from UBC on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Musqueam people. Every 2 weeks on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. we host a panel with collective members or an interview with an expert about topics surrounding gender, race, and social justice. Let's get intersectional.
Listeners, and welcome to today's episode of Intersections. Today we're going to be talking about gender and the family. Our panel of members are going to be discussing non-traditional family structures, the replicating of gender roles of traditional family within these non-traditional families, paternity leave, and working from home. So take a minute and rethink your own family structure. Take an opportunity to celebrate your found family, and bring a critical eye to gendered family behavior with our intersection panel's members.
Hi, everybody. I'm Bella, and while I am not yet a parent, this is a topic that I am very interested in discussing with everyone.
Hi, my name is Cora. I am also not a parent yet, but I intend to be in the next few years. And non-standard family units have been a big part of my life for the whole of it. So I'm happy to talk about this.
Hello, my name is Elle. I'm not a parent of my own kids, but I'm a parent of the world, and we're all a part of raising the next generation. I'm super excited for this conversation. This is like all I talk about, so.
Hi everyone, it's Fran here. How can this topic not affect us all? Like, obviously we've all been raised by some kind of parental or family unit in some form. And yeah, I'm really looking forward to getting into some details and some interesting discussion topics with y'all.
Hi everyone, I'm Hal, and I'm very excited to talk about non-traditional families like Cora and the role that they've had in my life and in my friends' lives.
Okay, so to get started, the topic that I wanted to talk about was paternity leave and kind of how that affects the family and everyone involved, and also how societal gender roles have really played a big part in parental leave and how that works within the structure of corporations. So first of all, as we kind of all understand, society has really created the expectation on the woman in the family to be the one that stays home and takes care of the new child or the children and the house, et cetera, to be like the housewife, while the father figure is like the breadwinner and is hard at work earning for their family. And then something else that I wanted to make a note of was that society is not very accepting towards men who do want to take time off and spend time with their family, and they're often not given as much time or any time to take off for paternity leave. However, taking time off for different parents can really affect their children and how their children are developing. So something to note is that it's really important for fathers to take time off to be able to spend time with their child, with the newborn, I guess. And it's better for the family, the child's development, to have that close contact with their father figure right from birth. But because women often receive more pay for maternity leave than fathers would for paternity leave, families are basically penalized for having the father stay at home while the mother is at work. And this is really like a vicious cycle where the father will earn more and have to take less time off, but the mom has to take more time off and be paid less, which is kind of encouraging her to stay at home permanently and to become a housewife. And we see this a lot because women tend to have to put their career on hold by working part-time or not at all when they're having a child. But some men are given what's called a fatherhood bonus, and they receive more money for when their wives have children, just because they're expected to be bringing home money for the family as the breadwinner. So an important kind of example case study that I wanted to bring up is paternity leave in Iceland. So in Iceland, the mother and the father each get 3 months of 80% paid parental leave, and then they get another 3 months to split between them. So it's just kind of a very different structure than we're used to. Also important to note that Iceland consistently ranks at the top for the most gender equal countries. But yeah, so their structure allows parents to have more equal time with the infant, and then the mothers don't need to put their career on hold like they do in other places like Canada or notably in the US. So my first question for you guys is, do you have any ideas or outstanding thoughts or suggestions on how we could kind of mitigate this problem and make parental leave something that's more beneficial to family development?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think something that we don't talk about often enough is just the physical impact that pregnancy has on women. Because often when we talk about maternity leave, we talk about the mom being there to raise a child at a young age, and we don't actually touch on the physical impacts that this has on a person's body to have a child. And I think if we can find a way to culturally reframe maternity leave, not only as time spent with a new child, but also time physically recovering from a very painful and very physically demanding process, that could also change how we do think about maternity leave and paternity leave, because someone has to also be around to take care of their partner when they're in this very fragile physical state.
Yeah, that was exactly what I was going to talk about, is that it's better to have both parents at home, because this is like an exhausting process. I have watched parents go through like the early stages of having a child, and you need both people there, or like more people than just one, like the mother, quote unquote, taking care of the child constantly, because that's in itself a full-time job. And so is recovery from having a child, giving birth. That's a lot of work, and there's a lot of healing that you have to do, like physical regrowth of your body to get through that. And us trying to put it all on one parent, or having it like one parent and then the other parent, so you have to like alternate just so you can keep on top of like childcare time, doesn't give the people a chance to work on it together so that you can take the stress off of both of the parents and have it be a more equal and supportive environment.
Yeah, very true. I think that this question, like, it can easily get wrapped up in like who should work and who shouldn't. But it, I think at its foundation, comes back to how we value, or like how little we value, the importance of present parents in the way that we think about like how children come into a place within themselves where they believe in themselves and they know the things that they can bring to the world. And it's like they need present people there. And yeah, like that's where work really like takes a toll, I think. And in a lot of families, we have yet to figure out how to balance that. But it's definitely super important to engage and sit with, because it's complex and there's no like, it's not so black and white, right?
Yeah, to build off of Elle's point, as someone who's really young and has not put near any consideration or thought into having children at this point in my life, it's really astonishing to me how little time parents get off to be able to be with their child. Even in Iceland, which is like our good example in this context, 9 months is a really short amount of time when you're raising a child for 18 years or more, depending. So it's just really crazy to me to think about how you don't get time off. And I know that it's so important to be able to build that connection and a relationship like with your child, obviously, because they are your child. But yeah, it's just very shocking to me, and something that I'm definitely going to need to navigate as I get older and start thinking more about that. It's just at this point in my life, I'm shocked.
That's such a good statement to have on this podcast. I wanted to bring up the idea of the value again, and the value of caregiving, and how there's so little like monetary or social value placed on all of the effort of the caregiving. Like, so much onus is on the breadwinning and, you know, having a career and bringing in actual, you know, capitalist dollars compared to the, you know, societal value that you have, whether you're, you know, male or female, whatever, like, having that parental relationship with your child is just completely undervalued, underrated, and not recognized in any of the levels of government or even kind of collective society that we have.
I completely agree. And I think the fact that we do undervalue caregiving makes us think that it's an easy process. And in families, that often means that older children have to go into that caregiving role. As someone who's significantly older than some of my siblings, my dad was out working, so I kind of fell into that role because my mom needed the support. Like, you need someone there to support you right after pregnancy. And that often falls to older children who don't necessarily have the ability to care for people, but that's an expectation. In my own experience, I didn't see a gendered element to that because I only have sisters, but it also seems like with the expectations for caregiving of children, it is the girls who are expected to care for their siblings while the boys are allowed to kind of just do what they want.
This is somewhat unrelated, but I remember I was in a psychology class during my degree and we were talking about infant development, and my teacher, in front of like 300 people, said that paternity leave is an acceptable loss in the raising of a child. Like, it's not that important that a child ever meets their father at all in their development. And I was like, are you sure you want to make that statement in front of 300 impressionable early 20 somethings? Because that seems like a bold statement to put when, like, if you look at the way that we do currently have to handle child rearing, your older siblings have to take care of you. If you're an older sibling, you have to take care of your younger ones. Like, it's a bucket chain of care at best. And we put a lot of that also onto teachers who are there to teach and not there to be parents, which we definitely see a growing problem as our school system gets more and more messy. I wanted to bring up that direct quote from a 300-level psychology course. Fatherhood is an acceptable loss, apparently.
Okay, just one more thing to connect back to Hal's point. I think that what you mentioned about kind of the responsibility all falling onto girls and not onto boys, really, we can see that carry through as children age. And it's exactly like I was saying, how men are expected to be the ones that are like the breadwinner or receiving the so-called fatherhood bonus while the mother is like at home. First of all, recovering from pregnancy. Second of all, trying to take care of a newborn with like little to no help, depending on kind of, you know, their situation. I just think it's so interesting to see how those structures are reinforced by society, like as you get older. And it really does start from a super young age.
So what I'd like to bring to the chat today is non-traditional families. So children of divorced parents or single parents who chose to have children without marrying, or queer families or polyamorous families, just families of all shapes and sizes that aren't necessarily like the heterosexual nuclear family. I did some reading by Susan Golombek, and she shows in her research that families that don't fall along traditional gender lines are typically happier, and the children of those families are more successful academically and throughout their lifespan, including happiness in them, not just happiness in the parents. But they are subject to more social problems like poverty or discrimination, because, I mean, being a single parent, you get a lot of discrimination. Being queer, you get a lot of discrimination. Those are just like some facts of life, unfortunately. But I wanted to bring to you all like what you think about the future of non-standard and non-traditional parenting. As someone who's been polyamorous since I was 17, 18, somewhere in there, it's been like a concrete part of my future. I've always wanted kids, and I've always been polyamorous as far as I've been aware of the word. And so that's something that I've had to navigate. And I recognize that polyamory is currently kind of illegal for raising families in. That's a whole other thing. But I just wanted to bring to you the question of like, what do you think about non-traditional families? What's your viewpoint? What's your info?
I definitely think that as a society, you could say we're moving away from the notion of like the classic, what you could call nuclear family. And I think that's a good thing, obviously, for representation purposes and for better inclusion of like LGBTQ people or polyamorous people, people that don't really conform to that like plain, I guess, idea that people could have in their head of a family. One example comes to my mind. I'm not sure if any of you guys or the listeners have watched The Office, but there is a character in The Office that is CEO of her own company, and she goes basically to a sperm bank and is artificially inseminated and has a child. And there's a scene of her that we see kind of like once the child has grown up a little bit, where she like comes into the office and like after school, she says hi to her mom. And you can just, I don't know, tell the relationship between them is very strong. And I just think that even though that's not a main plot of the show, it does kind of have something to say for, I don't know, representation in media and things like that in more of a positive light and rather than a negative light. Cause I feel like a lot of times we see like single parent families in a negative way on how they're kind of like always down on their luck, or divorced families, like the children are never happy. But it's important that there are so many families in the world. And while there will be negative representations of everything, there's also a positive representation of everything, of single parents, of, you know, two moms, two dads, et cetera, et cetera. And I just think that it's really important to see that we are kind of moving away from the traditional idea of a family to be something more modern and more accepting.
I think one possible explanation for the study that Cora proposed is that when people don't fit into the traditional family structures, they're forced to take a step back and figure out what actually works for them. When I was 15, I realized I was queer. I had up to that point been raised on kind of 80s rom-coms. I had a very clear depiction of what a relationship should be. And then when that was no longer available to me, I had to step back and say, okay, why is this what a relationship is? Why is this what I want? Is it just because I've been told this is what I want? And I think this is something that also is very apparent in our culture surrounding weddings. There's, if you actually take a step back and think about a lot of the traditions in weddings, there's a lot of very harmful beliefs behind them. Like the idea, not only that it's a bride and groom, but that the bride wears white. And if you look at that to do with purity, to do with virginity, or the idea of the bride being given away, and that's something that still is so ingrained in our culture because that's just what we do. And then if you're coming to family and relationships and marriage from a non-traditional perspective, you can take that step back and say, well, I can't do what is just done. So why are these the things they're done? What do I want to keep and what do I want to get rid of?
Yeah, I want to follow up on that by saying that Susan Kolumbach's like study actually did talk about how non-standard families really have the chance to like re-examine what those relationships should be like. So in queer families, they have to look at each other and say, why are we in a relationship and why do we want to have children? And then they divvy up the functions of that relationship and the raising of a child in like a way that they want to do things and not in a way that it's expected them to do things. Like it's approached from a very different angle. And I also got to bring it up that people who are in non-traditional families generally want their children more. Like the study shows that they will have gone through more hardship to have that child. They have to go through adoption. They have to go through like IVF, in vitro fertilization, or other sort of complications that are not necessarily there for the traditional family. And just going through that, I think also gives you time to think about, do I want to do this? How do I want to do this? What's worth it to me? And I think that's beautiful and lovely. And I live that every single day. Like I'm going to have a child. It's going to happen and I want it. It's going to be very hard. And that defines like how much I already love this fictional child.
Going off of Cora's point, I think that being in a non-traditional family structure, especially like as the parental figures in the structure, basically strips the relationship down to its like bare bones or the skeleton in a way that allows it to be remade like from the ground up. So it's really just like examining the goals and the purposes behind things rather than just doing things for the sake of doing them or for the sake of tradition. And to speak to their second point, I would kind of say that almost criticism or hardships that non-traditional families face tends to bring them closer together. In terms of being more passionate about the child or wanting the child, I guess, in a sense, more than traditional families. But also single parents, I think a lot of the criticism that they can face kind of knits the family tighter together, just in a way that it's kind of like them against the world, which I think is something really inspiring and something that we have to take into consideration when we talk about things like this.
Yeah, I'll wrap up by saying, like, as a child of divorced parents who was partially brought up by a number of my friends' parents' families, like, I had a large community around me of people who were just willing to take me in and take me off my dad's hands when I was too much, because I very much was. And that really, like, defined how I think about families personally. And I, when I read this research, I found a lot of my own experiences neatly portrayed throughout this. And like the communal parenting method, where you say, you're not my child directly, but I'm going to start calling you my child, and I'm going to feed you, and you can come over like every single day of the week whenever you need to. It helped me get through a teenagehood that was troubled, let's say. And I don't think just my dad could have been able to handle that. I love you, Dad. You're great. You did such a good job. And I think that we should look for these communities to raise children in, and not like isolated within that nuclear family that we are expected to create.
The 21st edition of Doxa Documentary Film Festival returns May 5th to 15th, 2022. Committed to cultivating curiosity and critical thought, Doxa will present both short and feature films from across Canada and the globe, representing some of the best in documentary cinema. The hybrid in-person online festival will include both live and pre-recorded conversations with filmmakers, as well as some industry-specific events. Visit doxafestival.ca for more details.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
Yeah, that resonates a lot. The idea of having like many homes and like many places to live and stay, and the importance of that when a family is going through like turbulence. And I'm sure a lot of us have felt that if we were living with family during the pandemic and stuff. But I've had a lot of conversations with my mom recently, and we were actually talking about, yeah, gender roles in the family, just in our family, and how this idea of a vision that you have for like the perfect family when you meet someone, or when a relationship comes up in your life, and how that ends up affecting your, I guess, like the true nature of the relationships because of this kind of fantasy that we take on. And we kind of concluded that part of the fantasy is upheld through this idea of like what the man represents, and how what the man represents is kind of like working beyond your abilities and beyond your capacity, and not valuing like the continual need to come back to an emotional self, and trying to control things, and just honestly the lack of like love needed for continual transformation within family and relationships. But yeah, I'm interested to hear what you guys have to say about like how you think that the quote unquote man is embodied in family dynamics beyond just men, how it is upheld as an epistemology, which is a way of thinking, but also an ontology, which is a way of being. What is this like the man, and how do we uphold this idea as people in general?
Does this kind of tap into that idea of being very capitalist driven and career driven? And I mean, that's something that I'm trying to figure out myself, is like, do you really want a career? Like, you know, is it worthwhile putting all your time and energy into work for something, working towards something, and not spending that time with family. Like, is that something that could be seen as like that man element that's kind of then pervaded across the genders? Yeah, and just thinking about that in very individualistic idea towards family and like a unit. And I guess that touches on the ideas that Cora was talking about in terms of having like a much wider network, whereas we're currently talking about family as a very insular, self-contained, anti-collective type structure. I'll leave it there.
I think that for me, the notion of kind of the man or the father and the roles associated with that familial role really comes from my own family, which is very much so a traditional heterosexual, the man works, the wife stays at home and cooks. And that's kind of what I was exposed to as a child. And I think it had a really big impact on me, especially before I was exposed to, I guess I could say, like, people with different family backgrounds than me. And something I'd also noticed, like, social media, which kind of opened my eyes to all of the different familial structures that we could have, as we're talking about in this episode. But yeah, I just think that my notion of what a man was and what a woman was and their roles in the family was very much dictated by traditional values, as both sides of my family, my mom and my dad's side, come from really traditional backgrounds. I think that that really shaped me as an individual. But additionally, I would say it shaped me kind of negatively in the sense that I want to be different from them. And I kind of want to emphasize like less the man and the woman role in the family and kind of just working on being in a family as two people working towards a common goal rather than having set structures of what we want to do. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's just really interesting, especially being a Gen Z, I guess, individual. It really goes to show how many different, I guess you could say, like, options we have. So the options are really endless because obviously everything is a spectrum. And I don't know, it's really just eye-opening to me to be able to see that.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that shows that sometimes the rejection of gender roles can also be very restrictive in and of itself. I mean, especially as women, like, I really want to do traditionally masculine roles, like mowing the lawn in my future home. But as someone who's also very short, it probably doesn't make sense for me to be the one physically doing the lawnmower. But it's like, I have to do this because this is my way of rejecting what was placed on me. This is my way of kind of asserting my own autonomy. It's come to a point where different household tasks are so coded as masculine or feminine that when we want to reject against them, we sometimes try to force ourselves to do tasks that aren't practical, just like sometimes the gendered tasks, if you're fitting into traditional gender roles, also aren't practical. And there's still this meaning to each task that we do that we have to assign this value of, well, whatever household chores I do, I'm either rejecting the gender roles or I'm falling into them without just doing what makes the most sense in our individual family.
Yeah, Hal, building off of your point with the lawnmower, how when we're in, you know, this like state of resistance to these oppressive narratives, that we can end up going out of our way to prove ourselves to do these things, that we can do these things or that we won't do these things, that end up being beyond what we want to be doing or what feels good to us. Because we just get a bit lost and we don't really know where the line is of like what it is that we want. That even to feel enough, we still have to be and do more than what we are. That we made it, that we're there, that we're woke. But ultimately, it's like we're trying to prove it to ourselves, right?
To build off of that point, I definitely think that in my family, at least, there is somewhat of a jokey kind of atmosphere regarding gender roles. My dad, who I don't think really ever says anything with full seriousness intended, he's very much a jokester. He will sometimes make comments that are very much like, oh, well, why am I in the kitchen cleaning when I'm the father? You know, like, you're the daughter, that should be your job. And it's a joke. Like, I know it's a joke. And I promise everyone it's a joke. He's not genuinely serious, but it's just like goes to show the differences between like generations that we have, like the things that are okay to say. Like, I would never say that to someone, just because even if it is a joke, it's not really a funny one. I don't know. I don't laugh when he says it. I'm just kind of like, okay, ha ha, dad. And I don't know. I just think it really shows the differences in the generations, because my parents are older and I'm definitely younger. So it just really shows how much things have changed.
Yeah. It's so interesting to hear how all of our perspectives are shaped and formed by our own lives and experiences with families, and the stuff that we've lived through, right? So that's why I think it's just so important to have these conversations and give ourselves the space to break stuff down so we can really find our own specialness and uniqueness in it all. And yeah, as for the gender role of the man and what that represents, like with my question, for me, it really stands in as this force and this way of thinking that tries to like urgently push forward this vision of the perfect family, the nuclear family, if you will, through control, and in a way that undermines the continual transformation that happens within all relationships, which is, you know, their nature after all. The man is in tandem with the idea of being manly. That's what I'm trying to get at here, I think. And it lives in a way that tells us, whether we're men or not, that we just aren't yet like enough or there. So in this case, the gender role in the family is that which also upholds this pictured, you know, nuclear family that needs no external support or help, that does not succumb to hard times, and is in many ways robotic and predictable, free of, I mean, the messiness that comes with being human beings. That's what I mean by the limited ability to love that exists within what this role entails and asks of us. But how this can and absolutely is taken on by people that don't identify as men, you know, that's why it's a role, right? Maybe roles are a lot more shared and less differentiated than we think, and we can't necessarily pin toxic behavior on just one subgroup. So that's why I think it's just so great to hear your guys' perspectives through. I hope that for us all and anyone listening, this can be a reminder that each family, you know, is complex and special in an incomparable way. Although we can name these bigger structures that encourage and reinforce a particular looking familial setup, the expectation is always changing in unattainable ways. So remembering to let go of that fantasy a bit, because when we hold onto it so tight, onto these fantasies so tight, we lose so much of the present process of loving in the ways that we know how right now. But yeah, what other questions we got?
So I wanted to bring something slightly different, but obviously intersecting across all the other topics that we've been talking about so far. And so I wanted to bring to the table the idea of remote working, which now in the context of these larger discussions seems very, very niche and very specific. But I guess in the age of the almost post-pandemic, pre-next pandemic, I don't know, wherever we are in the pandemic cycle, remote working is obviously come into our daily lives for many people. I think there's like a third of Canadians working at home in 2021, according to a CBC article that I was reading. And I guess this whole shift in where the workforce is actually located has a huge knock-on effect, both positive and negative, for those familial duties that we were talking about, career progression and what that means and what that looks like and what you have to do in order to ascertain that career progression. And so this article was very short. Like, I wish I had a bit more in-depth information to kind of bring to you, but it does a good job job at summarizing some of the potential issues and opportunities that remote working has brought to us. So previously, remote working was seen as like quite a stigmatizing aspect, you know, like you would be giving someone special treatment, whether they have like a family responsibility or a caring responsibility or something else. Like it was very much seen as like an extra effort that we have to make with a particular employee. But now in this new age, it's actually being pitched to us as a perk of like, here's a bonus, work at home, it's more flexible, yada, yada, yada. There's an economics professor at UBC called Marina Adshade, and they're kind of highlighting that actually like not physically being in an office or your kind of work location means that you miss out on this more casual conversation, like the classic water cooler type conversation that they're kind of suggesting that links you to better jobs and more career progression and all that kind of stuff. So if certain people are working at home more often, does that mean that they miss out on those opportunities? If you're working at home, you can look after children more easily because they're right there, presumably. And you just have to like do both and live your best life and balance everything and kind of be sold that dream of, you know, having it all. Is this just another way of doing that? But what this researcher is saying is by having remote working as a kind of band-aid solution, or it seems like it's a solution, but it's not, does that mean that we don't even bother to correct any of the wider, more structural inequalities that still exist? You know, perhaps we should invest more in affordable childcare, for example, as opposed to relying on remote working to patch up those gaps in family responsibilities and caring. So I don't know, like, I kind of came away from this article having very mixed feelings. This disadvantage of career progression, this advantage of spending time with family, and obviously the actual benefits of being at home and being able to care for your children and pick up your children more easily and all of that practical benefit. Do you think this is a new way of working and this could really help with the family dynamic and having more present parents, having more than one parent at home potentially, depending on the work that they do? Or do you think that actually it just helps to avoid having to deal with childcare and it just packages it all together so the government doesn't need to offer any decent childcare at an affordable price?
I would say that with regards to what you were saying about like missed opportunities or connections at the workplace, I would say that for, you know, there's like two sides to every coin. And I think that while that's good, I don't know, while it's good, it's also bad, but just like kind of everything else about remote working. But I guess I would mention that, you know, though you may be missing the so-called water cooler conversations, you're also missing the office politics and the other sort of random stuff that when you really think about it is not necessary to your workplace experience. But something else I would mention is that I feel that definitely remote working is the way that, I don't know, things will go just based on convenience and costs and stuff, everything. And I think that it can kind of bring a family closer together, just kind of to draw back to the point that I was making earlier about the men traditionally being the breadwinner. I think this really helps to destigmatize men being at home and men pitching in to do more work, more cooking, more cleaning, more laundry, and to spend more time like with their family and build connections with their children that maybe they wouldn't be able to. Because I know that when my dad was working at the office, he would not work like late hours, but he would come home at like 5:30 or 6. Dinner would be on the table. My mom would be like, how was work? He'd be like, work was good. You know, it was just very kind of like plain cut and dry conversations. But now I think that because we're reducing stress, we're reducing transport time between kind of like to and from the workplace, it can be really beneficial to family structure and kind of like create that little close-knit community that a family is supposed to be, like that group of people that you can rely on.
Yeah, I feel like it's such a balance to be found with like the importance of present parenthood, but also the value of how people still need to be their own person and go out in the world and like achieve the things that they want to achieve and like make things happen and like not let their entire identity be consumed with being a parent, but rather integrate it in a way that like leaves room for other people to support and yeah, I guess I just think that the nuclear family structure like doesn't allow for positive support that makes space for people to continue to go to work if they want to go to work, but then also be present when they can be present and like all these things, because not that we want to have to work to live, but that wonderful things can happen in workplaces, right? And like a lot of joy can be brought there or had there. Yeah, being able to think about those things and not like neglect those ideas when you are in the context of a family, and taking out the anger that maybe is surfacing because of the lack of balance on each other, but rather like, okay, how do we address this as like a whole, and how do we work with this instead of against each other?
Yeah, I want to bring up that work from home office surveillance technology probably is going to make that more even work-life balance that remote working can provide significantly worse, because suddenly you're being surveilled in your own home, and I don't think you have the space to like transition from work self to home self, and you won't be given any of that time that would have been there to take care of your family, to be present in your home. That said, I think remote work is absolutely the future. I think it's given the right structure and support through like policies and such, could absolutely be major benefit for the health of a home life in the world, but in Canada specifically. But 8 hours of constant surveillance, if you're not pressing a computer key every, I think it was like 4 or 5 seconds, then you get dinged and you can get fired for that sort of stuff. I don't think that does anyone's home life any benefits.
There's part of me that think, okay, this is great. You know, like women who traditionally have to take part-time jobs or change their own work-life balance to attend to the childcare. Maybe that's shifting as well more rapidly because of this remote working. But I guess we'll just need to see how it develops and whether we do make that bigger shift to like the hybrid model.
A Tribe Called Red is the Hallucination with their new record, One More Saturday Night, featuring Javier Mighty, Tanya Tagak, and more out now.
Hey, what's wrong?
I want to go to therapy, but I can't afford it.
Well, did you know there's a show on CITR where you can get free therapy every other week?
Really? What's it called?
It's called Therapy Hour, and it airs every other Tuesday at 6 p.m.
You mean I can get free therapy every 2 weeks just by listening to the radio?
That's right, and it doesn't even cost you a dime.
Wow, I won't have to cry anymore.
Actually, crying is pretty good for you. I learned that by listening to Therapy Hour on CITR 101.9 FM, because everyone needs therapy.
But not everyone can afford it. You get what you need.
All right, for our final topic of this episode, I wanted to talk about the replication of gendered family dynamics in these non-traditional families that we've been touching upon a little bit. And I think it's first important when we're doing this to define what we mean by a traditional family. So in sociology, we have the term standard North American family, or SNAF, S-N-A-F. And this is your 1950s suburban marketing fantasy family. It's the husband who's the primary breadwinner. It's the wife, two children, white picket fence, that sort of thing. And that really is where you see these traditional gender roles fall into place, and it has echoes into the modern day. By contrast, we have non-traditional families, which I in particular want to focus on families of choice, which is something that we more commonly referred to as found family or chosen family, which is a group of people who typically aren't biologically related to each other, who come together to perform family, not perform as in it's something that isn't real, but perform as in they're going through the motions of family. So having dinner together a certain number of times per week or things along those lines. And these communities are very important to a lot of people and can be a stand-in for family during transitory periods in people's lives. So during university, or for people who their biological family ties are made conditional. This is why families of choice are very important in the queer community and something that resonates with a lot of queer people. And I want to point out a study by Thompson in 2005 who argued that non-traditional families tend to emphasize those aspects of traditional SNAP family life that they adhere to and de-emphasize those aspects that they subvert. And in this study, the case study that they brought up was lesbian parents who were looking to adopt children, and they often, even though they didn't have any biological ties to these children, looked for children who closely resembled physically both parents. And they were trying to fit into this traditional SNAP value that the child looks like the parents, because a big component of the standard North American family is biology. These aren't blended families. These are families that look very similar. You even go even further, it's like the daughters look like the mother and the sons look like the father, and they really have this close biological tie. And it's something that we culturally have kind of absorbed as a way of legitimizing a family. So these families that aren't generally treated the same, these non-traditional families, will sometimes imitate that in order to gain cultural legitimacy. And I think one example of that that we see in these families of choice in the modern day that we've all kind of normalized is the idea of the mom friend. And for people who aren't familiar, this is a friend who kind of stereotypically always has what you need in their bag. They're always giving you cookies, things like that. Generally just a nurturing person in the friend group. And I think it's really interesting that we call this person the mom friend, because just being nurturing and being caring for your friends is a major important component of a friendship. And yet we label this not only as a family relationship, but also as a feminized role in the friend group. And I think that this is one way that we're trying to legitimize kind of non-traditional families through the lens of traditional families. We're trying to say, yes, we're not traditional, but look, we're a real family because we have this role. And I think that is something that we have to be really careful of, those of us who are in non-traditional families, is making sure that we're not replicating the harmful gendered aspects of traditional family. So I want to ask if you guys have any other examples or any other thoughts about the ways in which we sometimes unconsciously replicate gender roles, even in non-traditional families.
I act like my dad in my friend groups and my found family. I am so much like my father. And I try not to be, because it makes me the dad friend and that misgenders myself a little bit. So that's a thing. But it also winds up on me taking over like physical tasks, because sometimes you need to move a big freezer and no one else can do that. But it's something that I'm aware that I should really be seeking like group work. With me have a like found family group of, I think, 12 or 13 people at the moment that I know of. You can get more than one person to do a task. And I wanted to call myself out as someone who does this. And this is like, even when you're like aware of it and you're trying to do your best, you still do it sometimes.
I think it's almost somewhat of a disappointing aspect of society to think about people that are in non-traditional families that are conforming or feel they need to conform to the aspects of a traditional family. I don't know, just as someone raised in a traditional family, I think it's something to be looked down on, you could say, that people that are in non-traditional or queer families feel they need to fit these values. That's disappointing for me as someone who is from a traditional family that's kind of like enforcing those values. And it's just surprising to me, because I feel like part of the, I guess, the thrill of being in a non-traditional family is being able to do things your way, and kind of to be able to pick and choose what aspects of traditional family life you want, which is a good thing. And if anything, it makes your family more genuine. But then on the outside, I think it's really depressing that you still kind of have to conform to what everyone else wants in order to be validated by society. And then without that, you're going to face kind of like a lot of criticism from, I don't know, like your family members at your family reunion that are asking you all sorts of questions that like you don't want to answer and just stuff like that. And it makes it really sad to kind of think about this state of society in that sense. But to be more positive about it, I do think that it's something that's becoming more normalized in media and in society, which is definitely good.
Yeah, I really agree with what you said there, Bella. It is unfortunate when you fall back into the same patterns that have done harm, and I wouldn't say are wholly negative, but have a lot of negative aspects in them. And it can also be very challenging to like question your learned familial patterns. like you aren't aware of it in the moment and you aren't thinking about how, oh, this is my dad's love language, just like silently doing things for people. It's just something that you've like, oh, this is how you care for people. This is how you're supposed to do things. And no, you can think for yourself out there, folks. Call myself out a little bit more. But I would say that like when you have more than just like two people in a found family, you definitely have room for people to take up other love languages and take up other tasks that they feel they can do that helps break down those barriers and helps break down those patterns and habits. As a personal experience, this is something that does occur and I appreciate it greatly.
I just want to thank you, Hal, for the introduction of the SNAF value into this conversation. Like, I'd never heard of that before, and it just is very novel and slightly hilarious and then also slightly depressing as well. And I just wonder whether we need to say something about the, like, and maybe it's changed, maybe it's got better in terms of like this whole gendered childhood replication of family activities. And I just can't shake the image in my mind of that classic, you know, cookery setup. And when we're playing like make-believe, you know, it's always the girls who go and pretend to be cooking. And, you know, there's all these kind of replica cleaning items that are made out of like pink and yellow plastic. And like, what does that mean? And why are we doing that? And why is that a toy? And what kind of values are we instilling in our children at a very young age as to who does what? And, but like I said, maybe it's better. I don't have an answer, but that's the image that I've got in my mind right now.
Another question that I don't have the answer to, and I don't expect anyone else to have the answer to, regarding the term SNAF, why is it North American and why are we not considering any other Eastern cultures that are not kind of like in the notion of what's on TV? I think that's a really important thing to think about, kind of like, because TV and the media is really what everyone sees, but North America is such a small part of the world, but yet it still somehow manages to dominate kind of family life and the ideal family structure. And I just would love to learn more or maybe do some more research about kind of non-North American families, SNNAF, if you will. But I don't know, I just think it's really interesting to think about how we are almost, and in North America, we are almost like the center of it all. And it just kind of makes me think why, and I don't know, it's just something I'd love to learn more about.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think it's really important, and what a lot of people have touched upon, that we just continue to hold ourselves accountable with how we do replicate gender roles. Even if we do fit into non-traditional families, it's not that we're immune from these. And we still have to take a step back, whether in a traditional or a non-traditional family, and just look at why are we enacting our family the way we do? Is it because this is how our parents did it? Is this because of how the media portrayed it to us? And is this what we actually want? And sometimes just taking that step back and looking at our families from an objective perspective can show us that maybe we are enacting gender roles or other roles that are very harmful, and that we still have space to grow and learn from those and embrace better systems of families.
Thank you for listening to Intersections, presented by CITR's Gender Empowerment Collective at 101.9 FM. We can always be reached by email at genderempowerment@citr.ca or on Instagram at genderempowerment_CITR for comments, feedback, and topic ideas. You can find our episode archive and show notes at citr.ca/radio/intersections. This episode of Intersections was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program. Our theme song is provided by John Allison Weiss. Tune in again in 2 weeks on Tuesday at 10 a.m. to catch our next episode.